As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hi there, thank you so much for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on this week's The Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. It's the usuals, me, Ali Maxwell, and these two, Michael Cox and Tom Warville. Tom, how are you this week? Have you been enjoying some Tuesday night action in the UEFA Champions League? We record this on Wednesday morning. I'm interested to know how you spent your Tuesday night.
Hello, Ali. Yes, all good. I was in the pub last night with the company of Michael and a few other athletic people watching the Liverpool game. There's a weird, high share of athletic employees, I guess, are either Spurs fans or Liverpool fans. So if you meet one of them, you're highly likely that they're one of the two. But there was a good group of Liverpool fans in there, and they got the result that they wanted.
It's like that phrase that in London you're never more than 3 feet away from a rat, or in the athletic offices never more than 3 feet away from a Liverpool or a Tottenham fan. Michael, were you in the pub watching the Champions League? I believe you guys had some athletic office football action for the first time in quite some time. How did that go? And who are the star players in the athletic ranks, I think, is what I certainly want to know, and I think probably quite a lot of the listeners as well.
Yeah, it's my first five-a-side, or six-a-side, since before the pandemic. So I think rusty is the word there. A lot of practice needed. I don't know if there were any particular standout individuals. I thought it was quite a high-quality game. But I wouldn't want to name-check anyone as particularly outstanding. I don't know who I would give man of the match to.
Okay, that's a bit boring, but fine. We'll move on. I'm excited about our podcast topic this week because we're trying something a little bit new and I think it could be quite good fun. Now, it's Michael's brainchild, really, Michael's main idea. And when Michael told me that this week was about a team bonding exercise, I thought, brilliant, we're getting that weekend in San Sebastian that we spoke about many moons ago, or at the very least, trying our hand at an escape room or something more classically team bonding. Then he said, no, Ali, it's a team building exercise. And Michael, I think it's one that needs a little bit of explanation. So could you introduce the topic and where it's come from?
Yeah, I think it's interesting when it comes to, last week we talked about Newcastle and the fact that they have been taken over with the expectation of new funds. Where should they strengthen, for example? Where is required? If you're trying to avoid relegation, as Newcastle probably are this season, in what positions do you need to be strong and in what positions can you afford a weakness? And the same thing can be applied to the top of the table. For example, Manchester United, I think, are a good example, a very obvious example, of a side with great quality in some positions and a big weakness in a couple of others. And there's different ways to approach this. There's some kind of theoretical academic papers about the impact on performance when you have weaknesses in certain positions. And there's also the historical examples of previous Premier League title winners, for example, who I think rarely have 11 top-class players. And usually there's a couple of, not necessarily passengers, but less able players who are there to do a job rather than to be a star.
So you expanded on this in an article on the site not too long ago. It was called "In Which Positions Can a Team Have a Glaring Weakness But Still Win the Premier League Title?" As you mentioned, almost inevitably it came from you thinking about this current Manchester United squad and whether it had the balance needed. And you did go back and look at historic Premier League title winning teams. So how many would you say had no obvious weaknesses?
I think it's very rare. I think you'd be going back maybe to Manchester United 2008 and 2009 in particular, where I just thought they had quality. They had a brilliant goalkeeper, great defence, lots of midfielders who could control the ball, a rotating band of very quick, versatile attackers. And I think particularly after they brought in Berbatov, because maybe their weakness in 2008 was they didn't really have a penalty box striker. After they brought in Berbatov, I think they were very complete. I think every team after that, you can say there are a couple of positions where they needed to upgrade, and maybe the closest to a really complete side in recent years would be the Liverpool team that won the league. But yeah, I think it's rare that you'd say a title winner is complete in every position.
And you're not the first person to consider the question, where do you need the extra quality in your team and where can you afford weaknesses? As you mentioned, you have turned to the Warville side of things, and you did find an academic paper written on this very topic. What were the main conclusions there?
Yeah, I went back and looked at an academic paper by the late Gary Gillard, who is someone we've mentioned a few times on this podcast before, who sadly died last year. But in 2018, he sent me a paper that he'd written for the Journal of Sports Economics that was basically comparing teams who had an even distribution of talent throughout their team and teams where they had some very good players and some less good players, shall we say. And one of his conclusions, and I'm kind of summarising choosing a couple of key phrases, was attacking benefits from heterogeneity. Conversely, heterogeneity has a detrimental effect on defending, and heterogeneous teams tend to leak goals. A weak link in the defence is a constant vulnerability which can be exploited by the opposition. And that suggests more or less that the quality of your attack is defined by your best player and the quality of your defence is defined by your worst player, which I think makes sense. I mean, I think Mohamed Salah improves a relegation battler more than Van Dijk does, because I think if you've got a great attacker, you can channel your attacks through him. If you've got a great defender, he can't cover for everyone. And along the similar lines, if you were to put me up front for Liverpool, I still think Salah and Mane would score quite a lot of goals and Liverpool would be quite good. I don't think I'd ruin things completely. But I think if you put me in place of Van Dijk, I think the opposition would target me and would score a lot of goals.
And based on all this chat, I'm going to set you guys to work later, the aforementioned team building exercise, which we will get to. Tom, football is not fantasy football in real life. Squad building is not quite fantasy football, but these sorts of questions are A, right up your street, and B, absolutely how teams have to think in terms of long-term recruitment planning.
Yeah, completely. I think there's an interesting angle that teams are now trying to be more efficient with their budget allocation and try and optimise which positions they should spend in. And I think that this conversation, you know, plays really nicely into that, because if you are going up to the summer, you don't really have any positions which are in, you know, urgent need of renewal or replacement. How do you go about actually making the team better? Do you make your kind of worst player and improve them, or do you kind of increase the level of your best player, even though that obviously costs a lot more? So there are obvious kind of implications of this challenge that you're setting on, you know, what teams are actually trying to do in real football.
It's a good point, isn't it, Michael? Premier League title winning teams is next summer transfer window. It's quite an interesting topic in itself. How do you build on a team that has just been the best team in the country? It's something that many teams have struggled with over the years, and invariably there's a bit of outcome bias, isn't there? If that team then doesn't retain the title, something went wrong the summer before. They either didn't add in the positions they needed to, or they added the wrong players, and sometimes it does get boiled down and simplified a little bit like that. But it's a fascinating recruitment question. You know, how do you improve on a team that's been the best?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to improve a title winner. I think it's a good thing in a way that teams have struggled, because we don't have the situation in Italy or Germany where team win the league again and again, which I think is very bad. Manchester City, I think in particular, those 2 years where they won the title before Guardiola arrived, so 2012 and 2014, they didn't strengthen well after that. They tried to, I think, beef up their squad. They tried to go for strength and depth, but didn't really improve the actual starting 11. And I think that's a tough thing to do for a manager, to be celebrating a league title while also thinking, I need to make some upgrades. But tends to be the best managers throughout history. Most obviously, Sir Alex Ferguson have done that more successfully.
Why don't we get stuck into our team building exercise, the main part of this podcast, because I've set you both to task here. You're both building two teams. We've mainly been talking about how do you build a title winning team and how do you improve on one. And that is going to be one aspect of it. But we didn't just want to make it easy for you. But we're also going to ask you to build a team that is expected to battle for relegation. That's objective is to survive in the Premier League. So for the first title winning team that we've got you to build, we allowed you 44 points to spend, for want of a better phrase. For the relegation battling team, you have 22 points to spend. We wanted to make it realistic, and those teams generally have less resources available in recruitment to the teams towards the very top. Now, I'm hoping we get two quite different approaches here. Michael, obviously, in writing that piece, has studied Premier League title winners historically. He'll have some ideas about how to build a squad, perhaps based on that. And Tom, we're hoping we'll apply some intensely smart data analytics to the question. But Michael, first and foremost, I said 44 points for the title challengers, 22 points for the relegation strugglers. Can you just talk us through the values? Each player has a value between 1 and 5, and we had to sort of go back and forth a little bit to decide what level each number meant.
Yeah, so theoretically, I mean, it's there's 5 different categories of player. A 5 out of 5 player is obviously a world-class player. A 1 out of 5 player would be bottom of the Premier League. So broadly speaking, we're saying a 1 out of 5 player is Norwich level, 2 out of 5 is Southampton level, 3 out of 5 is Everton level, 4 out of 5 is Arsenal level, and 5 out of 5 is Liverpool level. And just to back up that, the odds for those sides to win the league at the moment are 5,000 to 1, 2,000 to 1, 500 to 1, 150 to 1, and 3 to 1. And I think they're sides who broadly have an even distribution of talent throughout their side.
Okay, so without further ado, let's see how this goes. We're going to start with Michael. You're building a title winning side here. You've got 44 points to use on 11 players. So the average would be 4 out of 5. Now, hopefully you don't have 4 out of 5 for your full starting 11. Otherwise, this podcast could be incredibly short. I'm hoping that you've been a little more thoughtful in assembling your team to win the title. Would you like to talk us through it?
Yeah, well, I mean, first and foremost, I thought maybe you could consider, because you're a good team and because you probably won't have many shots to save, I did think about maybe trying to save some money essentially in goal. But actually, I looked through the last decade, the title winners, the goalkeepers have been Cech, Van der Sar, Joe Hart when he was a very good goalkeeper, De Gea, Courtois, Schmeichel, Edison and Alisson. You don't have anything less than real quality in that position. So, I mean, I kind of go back to what I said about Gary Gillard's paper, in the sense that I don't think you want any weaknesses in your defence. So the most boring bit of my side is the back line. I think just a four out of five player in goal and in all four of the back four positions, I think is basically the way to go. I don't necessarily think you want a real standout centre back and then a weak left back or something like that. I've just got quality across the board.
It's interesting because this is hard to do in the exercise that we're taking on here. But in the piece, you did mention that central defensive pairings for Premier League title winners have quite clearly been all about partnerships, really, and not necessarily based on the individual quality of the players. There are some who are obvious stars, and there are some who you look back 10 years later and you think, they won a Premier League title as part of a back two, as part of a central defensive pairing. Decent.
Yeah, the partnership is the key, isn't it? I think City last year were a good example of that. John Stones, the previous year or two, had really been on the fringes of the side and some expected him to leave. But then when they brought in Ruben Dias, who's just a very kind of strong, physical, muscular, slightly old school centre-back, Stones was suddenly really perfect for playing alongside him. So yeah, they had the balance there.
So you're playing 4 at the back. Can you just quickly chat us through the formation? Have you thought about general team strategy and style? I mean, you're going for the title. There's a certain way one should probably play, and I'm sure you're not moving too far away from that.
No, just a simple 4-2-3-1 I've got. But yeah, back four, I think, made most sense.
And double pivot?
Yeah, so further forward, there's a bit more variation. In the centre of midfield, I think rather than just having 2 4-out-of-10 players, you're best off with a real superstar who can try and dictate and dominate the game. And then I think alongside him, you can have a little bit of a runner, almost someone who maybe does the dirty work and yeah, plays a bit of a subordinate role. So a little bit more of a contrast in that position. And then the same thing for going further forward, I mean, almost a front four. I think, again, rather than just a consistent quality of player throughout that attacking unit, you're best off loading up on a couple of real superstars. So two, 5 out of 5 players, 1 4 out of 5 player, and then actually the only 2 out of 5 player. So I think in your front four, you can afford someone who basically does a job for the team. Often in that kind of situation, they're kind of going to be tracking back more. They're going to be tucking inside. They're going to be making sure the side aren't vulnerable to counterattacks. But, you know, I think this is
a winger, right? One of your wide positions?
Yeah, almost certainly a winger. I think in some situations, maybe you might have two real superstars out wide and your player who's in the number 10 position plays a bit more of a workman-like role. But it's very rare for a team to win a title without one or generally two real world-class attacking players. And I think it's, you know, if you have a good manager who can manage everything efficiently, I think it's worthwhile. And I suppose my inspiration here, and I understand they're a bit of an anomaly, but Leicester City, when you look at the way they played, a very solid back four, no real standout players, but there was almost partnerships. I'd say there was three partnerships in the midfield and attack. There was Okazaki and Vardy. Vardy had a fantastic season. Okazaki really just doing a job. Mm-hmm. Kante and Drinkwater. We know Kante is a world-class player. Drinkwater actually had a good season, but you'd say was less of a superstar. And then I think particularly out wide, you wouldn't usually think of that as a partnership. But I mean, Mahrez won player of the year. And on the other flank, Albrighton, again, had a very good season, but was playing a completely different role to Mahrez. He was deeper. He was tucking inside more. He was defending more. And that's the kind of balance that I think is, you know, we know Leicester didn't have quality across the side. If you average out that starting 11, it wasn't the average quality wasn't a title-winning player. But they had four real superstars, Vardy, Mahrez, Kante and Schmeichel, in key positions. And around that had, one, a solid defence with no particular weak individual, mm-hmm. and two, players in those partnerships who could play the balancing role, which, you know, I think that's the kind of thing that this is all about.
Just for the purposes of my notes, I've got you with 4 out of 5 players, 1 in goal and 4 at the back to start with. Then you're 2 in the 4-2-3-1, a 5 and a 3, a star and a water carrier, if you will. I've got a 2 out of 5 out wide, a Southampton level player for this title winning side in your terms. I've got a 5 out of 5, a superstar in the other wide position, probably a large goal threat, you would imagine. And then between the 10 and the striker, who would you rather have as a 5? Your number 10, pure creator with a 4 out of 5 striker, or a 5 out of 5 striker with a 4 out of 5 number 10?
Let's go for a 5 out of 5 number 10, because I think they influence the game more. But again, I think that can be a partnership. I think it can work either way. I think you can find examples of strikers who basically do the running and play a hold-up role for a star player just behind. But yeah, can work either way.
Well, you're true to form, because one of the big takeaways from the article that you wrote was that very particularly you felt the central midfield positions were where glaring weakness was not acceptable, was not conducive to title-winning teams. So here you've got a 5 and a 3 with a 5 in the 10 position. That's there's plenty going on there for you.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that was really part of the reason why the article was written around Manchester United, because central midfield is not an area. I looked back through every Premier League title winner, and the areas where I don't think any sides had a glaring weakness were, I mean, definitely central midfield. Everyone had at least one really good central midfielder, and usually a goalkeeper as well. There's a couple of examples where there have been injuries to top-class goalkeepers, but yeah, in general, goalkeeper and central midfield, I don't think you can really have a weakness.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Time to welcome Tom Warville to the podium. Been sitting quietly, been musing on Michael Cox's take on Leicester City's 2014-15 side. And I'm really interested to hear how you approach this, Tom. I just have one question about the goalkeeper spot more generally, because hard to argue with what Michael said about the goalkeepers who have won the Premier League titles in the last 10, 15 years or so. I wonder if in data analytics terms, you could talk us through whether there's been work done on, let's say, the difference between a goalkeeper who's the best in the league versus league average, or perhaps league average versus the worst goalkeeper in the league. What sort of thing are we talking about in terms of goals prevented and therefore points won, I guess, ultimately, which has to be what this is all about for the goalkeeping position?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I haven't really seen too much about kind of translating the difference between the goals you concede and what you'd expected to concede, and that number, whether it's, you know, plus six or minus six. I've not really seen it converted into points too often, just because I think it's a difficult thing to try and pinpoint, like which saves won or lost certain points or what that means on average. I imagine that you could work that out. But I think usually it's between the realm, just not really going off anything scientific, just from memory, that the worst keeper in the league is usually worth around, you know, minus six, minus eight goals versus the average keeper, and the best is usually worth something similar to that as well. Okay. And these are usually guys who play most of the minutes in a season too. So
that could be quite a crucial difference between a side that concedes, let's say, 28 goals in 38 Premier League games and has potentially the best defensive record in the league, or 36 goals in 38 games, still less than a goal a game, but perhaps not quite strong enough to really give them the platform to dominate.
Yeah, I think I thought quite a lot about kind of the goalkeeper position in this exercise, because do you care more about a good shot stopper who's probably not going to face that many shots anyway for a title winning side, or do you care more around having a better kind of 10 players ahead of him that are going to suppress more shots and make his job a bit easier? And I think for a title winning side at the margins, you probably still want at least a 4 out of 5 rated keeper. Mm-hmm. You could maybe argue that you get a 3 out of 5 rated keeper and shuffle that extra point that you've gained elsewhere, probably strengthen the back line somewhere. But I've gone for a number 4 out of 5 at the back, just because I think that it's probably worthwhile that at the margins, you know, you look at an Edison, you look at an Alisson, you look at perhaps not title winning, but, you know, David De Gea's form this year, Edouard Mendy, another example. These are all keepers who are definitely kind of, you know, in that 4 out of 5, perhaps the 5 out of 5 spots. And I think for a title winning side, I mean, we're thinking with a goalkeeper, it's more than just saving shots. When Man City got Pep in, they obviously replaced Joe Hart with Bravo, and Bravo was about as good as his feet as Joe Hart was as good with his feet. I think those two were probably, you know, threes in this exercise. So getting someone that's a 4 that can do a bit of both, I think, is really, really important, both stylistically and also just skills wise. They're actually a good goalkeeper.
Any difference in formation compared to Michael? Talk us through your back line, your defensive structure.
Yeah, so you can probably sense a bit of a theme of the team that I've modelled this around, but I've gone for a 4-3-3. And again, I mean, I've gone for the two fullbacks, which are 4 out of 5s. And I've flitted between having the two centre-backs either a 4 and a 4, because I'm thinking injury-wise, if you get an injury to the 4, the one that's remaining, the kind of quality drop-off isn't as high. But I've gone for a 5 and a 3, because I'm imagining there's some sort of synergy effect of you have one world-class centre-back which can organise the rest of the back and perhaps, you know, bring the quality up of the players around him.
It's Virgil van Dijk. It's Virgil van Dijk.
But I do think, I mean, I'll say that's what it is, but I think maybe there is another big argument the other side, you know, to say if he, you know, you see what happened last year, he got injured. If Liverpool had two four out of fives at the back instead of a five at the back and a three, which is probably what Matip is, would they have been in as disastrous a position as they have been? Mm. And it's maybe the same as well for Leicester City. You know, Wesley Fofana's £40 million for a 20-year-old, which is a lot of money, when if you bought two £20 million centre-backs for them, is that arguably a better allocation of resources? Mm. Or at least another, you know, two £20 million players in the squad. Doesn't have to potentially be a centre-back.
Mm.
So that's my back line. In midfield, I've gone for a three, a four, and a four, and that's mainly so I can save another point to go forwards.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it's good to have a balance there. You're probably only as good as your worst player in that midfield, but having a, you know, a three, I can't remember which team we said is the kind of, you know, the Everton level,
yeah.
Perhaps, yeah, don't really want Andre Gomez in there, but yeah, that kind of Everton.
Maybe a Decore.
Yeah, exactly. A Decore is a, you know, a nice player to have in there. I would say as well that I do think the distribution of points within teams can differ as well, but that's a whole different podcast. and then up front, I think I've gone for just one of the spots as a five. I'm undecided as to which. It's probably, you know, you can have the left winger as a five or maybe the striker as a five, but I think, you know, 5-4-4 across the front line just to give you that extra kind of star power up there. Alongside two other players who are just very good as well. So I think to win a title, you need to be better going forwards and scoring more goals than you are at the back. I think most title-winning sides, which we've discussed, are usually very, very solid going forwards, and that's kind of how I've modelled my team in this exercise.
It's interesting to me that Michael referenced the paper by the late and great Gary Gillard, and his takeaway seemed to be that the weak link in defence was something to very much avoid. And that's why Michael had fours across the board. You've got a three in your defence. And he also said that you probably is your quality of attack is defined by your best player. Michael's got two fives in his front four and a two. The only two in either of these title-winning sides. And you've kept it a little bit more uniform with a 3-4 and four in midfield and a 4-4-5. That is a pretty spicy front line you've got there. Okay, so, I mean, enough difference for me to think this has been a worthwhile exercise, but not enough that you guys are clearly completely opposed about how to build a title-winning team. Do you think in general football analysis and punditry, I suppose, probably the best word for what I'm trying to say, there's a desire to pick out one of two centre-backs in a partnership as being the better one? And do you wonder whether, potentially just due to some sort of outcome bias, we lean towards the dominant one, the ball-winning one? You know, I think we've spoken about it before with Tom. You sometimes feel a little bit bad for the non-alpha centre-back in a partnership because they're not going to be at the top of the stats for interceptions, for aerial duels, for tackles, whatever it might be. They kind of play the more passive role. And I wonder sometimes whether those sorts of players get less credit almost by default, which, again, doesn't quite feel fair.
Yeah, I think you're right. I can think of a few examples of that. Maybe not title-winning size, but kind of mid-table teams. I remember when Fulham were punching above their weight and got to the Europa League final, they had Hangeland and Aaron Hughes. I mean, Hangeland was a very good centre-back, don't get me wrong. But because he was so physical and dominant in the air, I think he got the attention, whereas Aaron Hughes was actually a really good, intelligent partner for him. I used to think of Gareth McCauley as a bit like that, often played alongside physical players like Jonas Olsen, but often I thought he was better. And I think someone like Johnny Evans, it's taken people most of his career to work out how good Johnny Evans is. But I thought he was always excellent at Manchester United alongside Vidic or Ferdinand. Okay, he tailed off in his last couple of years there, probably needed to move. But yeah, players like that, I think, do slightly go under the radar. And often it's the centre-backs who don't do noticeable things that I really like watching and I think are undervalued. I think of Christensen at Chelsea like that, you know, a player who I think, again, probably took a while before people realised how good he was because he's not as obvious as, I suppose, John Terry or Gary Cahill or some of those other, David Luiz, you know, some of those other Chelsea centre-backs in recent years.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So let's move on to the relegation battle side that you both need to build. And just lastly, on your title-winning sides, it's interesting to me and maybe reflective of your two personalities that Michael's gone with more extremes. He's got two in his team, which Warville has completely ignored. But he has got three superstars, whereas Warville's only got two in his side. Quite interesting stuff, I think. We're going to give you 22 points, half of the budget, and your sole objective is to avoid relegation. And we studied how to survive last year, then we studied how to stay up in your second season last year. It's a topic that we've spent quite a lot of time on, that particularly I'm very interested in as someone who covers the Championship closely and is keen to get a better grasp on which Championship promotion sides are well set to stay up and which aren't, because it's not always as easy as who won the title with more points and more goals and fewer conceded. But in this instance, 22 points, so an average of 2 out of 5 for your starting 11. Again, the question is, do you fill your team with 2 out of 5 players and hope that that means you're slightly better than the bottom three, or do you vary it? Well, let's start with Tom. You can go first this time. I think it's trickier to go second. Why don't you run us through how you started this one?
Yeah, so I've gone for a 4-1-4-1, and I just think that means that you can probably, you know, you've got 5 in midfield, which from a kind of defensive point of view is useful, and more often than not, you're going to be defending in a relegation fight against most teams. And I think that I'm trying to gear it a bit towards being good at defending, and with, you know, with that in mind, how do we cope under that pressure? So I've gone for a 3 in goal, and I think that's because when I think of Burnley with Nick Pope, Palace with Vicente Gaeta, Martin Dubravka when he's fit, I think that you're going to be facing a lot of shots and you need a above average goalkeeper to kind of bail you out.
I was going to say it's worth pointing out, because we've just been talking about a situation where 4 out of 5 is the average. You picking a 3 out of 5 in goal is above the average of your sort of per player budget. So we have to recalibrate a little bit how we're rating these players. 3 out of 5, strong goalkeeper.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's because, like I said, you're going to be busy in goal. You're going to have to do a lot of work. And I think having someone, again, at the margins who's better than average, I don't think as a collective you can do too much in terms of, for the outfielders, do too much collectively in terms of suppressing the number of shots and the quality of shots that you're facing, because realistically you're capped by the amount of talent you can have because of such a low point allocation. So, yeah, I've gone for a 3 in goal. And then across the back line, I've mixed it up a little bit. So I've gone for 2 centre-backs, which are both 2s, just because I think that you need someone who's just, you know, average to control the centre of the pitch. And then at the left-back, I've gone for a 1, and right-back, I've gone for a 2.
Why is it always the left-backs? Still, still getting marginalised.
Subconsciously, yeah, I'm slandering the left-backs there, but I've gone for that because I think it's probably good to kind of share around the weaknesses across the team. Now, I could either have like a really strong right side, a really weak left side, and vice versa. But in midfield, I've gone for a 2 at left mid and a 1 at right mid. So your average on those flanks are 3. Your average is 1.5, but your combined is kind of a 3 across those two players. So you're kind of sharing where the weakness is. So it means that, you know, going forward on the left are probably slightly better. Defending on the right was slightly better. Maybe that asymmetry is easy to attack, but I thought, given we're probably doubling up a lot at the back and defending a lot because of the team that we are, that kind of, you know, imbalance will be masked a little bit. In midfield, then, I've gone for a defensive midfielder who's a 3, and the 2 other central midfielders are 2s apiece. And I think that's because you need a kind of real leader at defensive midfielder. You need someone who can coordinate with the back line and the midfield, is a good individual ball winner. And I think of someone like a Declan Rice in that situation, who he himself probably isn't a 3, but if we're going by kind of this scoring system, he's probably around that. And I think that, you know, someone who can do a bit of everything in there would be handy. And then the 2s are just, you know, league average players who can do a job in that situation.
And that leaves you with 1 up top, and I think he is a 2.
Yeah, 2, yeah. Good. So I'm glad that our maths checks out. Wouldn't play darts with each other. I've gone for a 2 up front. I just think, I mean, I've got no points from elsewhere. I think we've done the kind of relegation pod previously, and I think that having a kind of better defence is more important to stave off relegation than having a very good striker. So, yeah, I think that is my team.
A strong core, you have to say, or at least a core that lacks weakness, maybe more specifically, in that your ones are at left back and at right midfield. Your threes, your best players are in goal and sitting in front of the back four. And then the two centre-backs, the two centre midfielders and the striker, all 2 out of 5 sort of average players for what we're discussing, for the level that we're trying to reach here. The 4-1-4-1, not the most exciting thing I've ever seen, Tom. We're not here to excite, we're here to survive.
On that, like, you could try and think of something a bit more exciting, but I think this is a separate thing of, you know, the coaches for a lot of these relegation threatened sides are the ones that they turn a 1-2 and a 2-3 at times based on their system. You know, Dyche, Hodgson bailing Palace out year after year when the quality of that squad wasn't very good. So I think that the differentiator more often than not isn't, it probably is, you know, covering your weaknesses in an exercise like this, but it's also, can you get a coach who is well drilled and that can actually make the most of them and turn a 22-point squad into a 24-point squad. Points in this exercise, not in the league table, because you're getting relegated on 24 points.
What you're saying is, if you were hiring a manager, they would be at least a 3 out of 5 in the dugout, and therefore improving the quality of your side by default. Michael, one thing I didn't want to bring up, but I will now, is that one of the things we spoke about on the podcast about staying up in your first league in the Premier League and any themes and trends from the last 10 years or so was in having quite an unusual tactical style. A team like Sheffield United in their first season under Chris Wilder, Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds, of course, thrived in a style that I suppose kind of bloodied the nose of more established Premier League sides. I wonder if of the three, maybe it's easy to say because they're clearly the best of the three so far, but Brentford, we've spoken a little bit, having an unusual style, and perhaps you wouldn't say that about Watford and Norwich City. Now, for this sort of points allocation, fantasy football style draft, I'm not going to pin a tactical style on you, but that was just something that sprung to mind when I thought about the differences between building a title-winning side and a side that's going to be battling against relegation.
Yeah, I had a slightly different approach to building my team for survival. If 2 out of 5 is the standard, I went for 2 out of 5s across the back four. As I said before, I don't think you really want a weakness there. I think you need a good goalkeeper. They're going to have to make a lot of saves, probably. And therefore, I think it's worth upgrading in goal. And I also think, going back to what we said earlier about that academic paper, if your attack is defined by the quality of your best attacker, I think it's worth actually going nearly all out and having a 4 out of 5 attacker there. I think of Grealish at Villa. I think of Zaha at Palace. I think those players elevated their teams to greater heights. And I think it basically works as long as you've got the right structure. So in response to that, I've only got a 1 out of 5 up front. I'll have a kind of battering ram who can make the runs and hold the ball up and maybe score 7 or 8 goals, but is by no means a superstar. I think that's fine. And a couple of downgrades in midfield as well. So I've gone for 2-2-1-1 across midfield. So not a particularly strong midfield, but I think if they can do the job, protect the defence and get the ball to the near superstar with some kind of regularity, I think this team would be all right.
3 in goal, 4 2s across the back four. You've got a 4 out of 5, an absolute star man currently in the number 10 position, basically, with a 1 up front. Could you just fill in the blanks for me? 2 central midfielders and 2 wide players.
2-2-1-1 across the midfield. So I've got a weakness at central midfield and a weakness out wide.
Oh, you've put them on the same side as well. The left central midfielder and the left midfielder are an absolute disaster.
Yeah, that is interesting. That is interesting. But yeah, again, kind of going back to the Leicester thing, looking at it as two partnerships, having, I don't think you want two dreadful wingers and I don't think you want two dreadful central midfielders. But if you can balance the weaknesses out a little bit, I think you've probably got a decent team.
I think a lot of what you've both said has made a lot of sense and I have found it really interesting as a general topic to discuss, but then hearing your individual thoughts as well. Very similar theme to our title winning side. The differences between your two sides are, Michael, slightly more at the extreme end, both with a 4 out of 5, a superstar that Wolves team is missing, or rather not a superstar, that would be 5 out of 5, but a superstar in the relative terms that we're talking about, but also with 3 1 out of 5 players, very, very poor individuals for the league, whereas Tom just has 2 key weaknesses in his side. Yeah, enjoyed it. Genuinely enjoyed it. And probably more so than ever before, this is a podcast where I want to hear from the listeners, because I'm afraid I'm one of those people that finds these sorts of exercises bizarrely exciting and interesting. Anything to do with drafting, anything to do with points allocation, it's just right up my street. So please do get in touch with us. You can either tweet us, and you can find us pretty easily on there, or you can comment on the podcast episode page on the Athletic site, especially if you have more creative, more extreme ideas than these two. Those are the ones I'd most like to hear. I'd like to spend some time over the next few days really going through what people think about this while I muse myself. It is difficult listening to Tom and Michael because they tend to make quite a lot of sense, but I reckon there are some other options out there, and I'd be really keen to hear about those. So there you go, a slightly different style of pod this week, a theoretical team building exercise. Where do you need quality in your team, and where can you afford weaknesses? Once when you're building a title contender, and once when you're building a relegation battler. Get in touch with us. It'd be great to hear from you. And if you've got any other ideas on this sort of theme, please do let me know, because that's the sort of thing that I will be pushing to form the basis of future episodes of this podcast. We are the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. Michael Cox and Tom Warville have been providing the goodness on here, and outside of the pods, that's what they do every day on the Athletic site. If you'd like to sign up, give it a go, so that you can read Michael and Tom's pieces, theathletic.com/tactics will get you 33% off an annual subscription. There's so much good stuff going on there as well. I'm hoping that one day Michael will make will write a tactical breakdown of one of these office six-a-side games, but from his answer earlier, it doesn't seem forthcoming anytime soon. Join us next week on the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast, and thanks so much for listening.
The Athletic.